All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. Our guest is Jeremiah Gulka. He formerly was a lawyer in the Bush Department of Justice, and he wrote this monograph for the RAND Corporation back in 2009 called The MEK in Iraq, the Mujahideen Khalq in Iraq, A Policy Conundrum. And then we talked about his piece a couple weeks ago here on the show that he wrote over at Glenn Greenwald's blog, two pieces actually, at Glenn Greenwald's blog, about the MEK and about the American politicians who work with them. So welcome to the show, Jeremiah. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. I appreciate you joining us today. There's so much to go over here. I guess could we start with, you know, the ancient history? You get into that in one of your articles here at Salon.com at Glenn Greenwald's blog. Where exactly the MEK comes from back in, what, the mid-70s?
Yeah, it started in 1965. It was founded by a group of graduate students at the University of Tehran who wanted to take action to oppose the Shah and his government, which they saw as a puppet of the United States, and of course the U.S. Did do a coup and install the Shah, so they weren't wrong on that. The Shah's government got wind of their intent and suppressed the young group fairly hard. All of its leaders went into prison, but the group got a fair amount of support over the years, and one of the leaders survived prison. His name was Masoud Rajavi. And as the Iranian Revolution got closer and it started to happen, the MEK was one of many groups to oppose the Shah. And in the wake of the revolution, this group, which now had a fair amount of support, hoped to participate in the new government. Masoud Rajavi intended to run for president. There were several candidates who were hoping to run for the Majlis, which was the parliament Iranian government, but perhaps in response to the kind of strength of the MEK's support, Ayatollah Khomeini suppressed the group, kept them out of the running for office, and in response to that, the MEK turned its aim on Khomeini's regime. They got violent and did some attacks against the regime, which responded by brutally suppressing the MEK. And you know, since then, there's been a history of brutal suppression of the group by the regime. And the leaders did a self-exile to protect themselves, since they left for Paris in 1981. They, at this point, turn their attentions to, well, the leaders turn their attentions to courting Western public opinion, because at this time, you know, it's the revolution, it's after the embassy hostage crisis, and the new government of Iran didn't have a lot of fans in Western Europe or in the United States, and the group starts promoting itself as a potential replacer for the Iranian government. And it creates something called the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, which is its political arm. Meanwhile, the MEK members who were in Iran went underground to protect themselves because the government was suppressing them. Now, in 1986, the MEK does a deal with Saddam Hussein, who had instigated the Iran-Iraq War, which was an absolute catastrophe for Iran. And under this agreement, the MEK moved to Iraq, where Saddam provides them with camps, several camps that are near the Iranian border. It provides them with weapons, munitions, and money, in exchange for which the MEK will participate in military incursions into Iran, provide intelligence, provide interrogation and translation on Iranian POWs. Now, this turns out to be probably the biggest mistake the MEK has ever made, because it didn't work out. They were hoping Saddam was going to provide the military support to put the MEK into power in Iran. It didn't happen, and in the process, whatever support the MEK had in Iran was wiped out, because now, you know, this group has been, you know, this viewed as a traitor for having lined up with the aggressor in that terrible war and participating in interrogating and killing Iranian soldiers. So now the group is out in the desert in Iraq with not a lot of friends in Iran. It's keeping up its violent attacks against Iranian government officials in Iran and even abroad, even in the U.S. and in Europe. And the leader, Massoud, he starts turning the group into a cult of personality. He, in 1985, before they went to Iraq, he arranged a divorce between one of the one of his leader colleagues and that gentleman's wife. And Massoud then marries this woman. So now Massoud Rajavi and Miriam Rajavi become the co-leaders of this group. And they start turning it into a cult group. And they're, of course, the MEK vigorously denies this because no one wants to be called a cult. It doesn't sound good. But the evidence I saw when I was at the RAND Corporation and I was in Iraq conducting research for this and the interviews I did with former members and the evidence the Human Rights Watch found in a report they did shows that you have a lot of the types of behaviors that are viewed as cultic, such as sexual control, in this case, a mandatory celibacy, mandatory divorce. They have gender segregation, emotional isolation, which means that the members of the MEK were separated from family internally after the mandatory divorce. Their children were sent off the homes in Europe, so there are almost no kids there. Their families back in Iran were told that they had died or been killed by the Iranian government. Then you also had limited access to media. They had, MEK provided its own media to its people and banned other sources. There was limitations on food, there's sleep deprivation, and mandatory work projects, which were done to promote the kind of ideology of the group. And so
now, pardon me, this litany of the cult-like behavior, this is stuff that you witnessed yourself when you went there to investigate for the Pentagon's think tank, the RAND Corporation. Is that correct?
Well, what I saw bits, and most of the details I learned from talking to former members of the MEK who were in a little facility that was next door to the MEK's facility, which is called Camp Ashraf, in Iraq. What I saw directly was we went in on an unannounced visit one night to Camp Ashraf and saw the people in there.
Well, we'll go ahead and go to break, and we'll let you elaborate back on that when we get back. And then, of course, we'll also have to talk about all of the very powerful lawyers and politicians and former generals who are shilling for this communist terrorist cult. It's Jeremiah Gulka from the RAND Corporation. We'll be right back after this. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Jeremiah Gulka. He used to work for the Bush DOJ, then went to study the MEK cult at the RAND Corporation. And by the way, I was mentioning just a minute ago about how our friend Phil Giraldi, former CIA counterterrorism officer, wrote me that email saying, oh, don't you believe the hype about Hezbollah sleeper cells all over America. Well, Phil tells the story that when he went through counterterrorism training at CIA, that, you know, I don't know if it was out at, you know, the farm or whatever, some place, they build a mock-up, maybe on a military base or something, they build a mock-up of a terrorist situation. Here's what happens if a terrorist tries to kill you, you know, so you can practice. Well, they're reenacting an MEK attack on Americans in Iran in the 1970s. And, you know, a truck bombing can happen to you in the blink of an eye, so be careful. Here's your scenario. That was how they trained Phil to protect himself from terrorists in the first place, using the MEK as a model. Anyway, so we know them now as a front for the U.S. Department of Defense, which apparently hired you to go study them, and for the Mossad. Now, lately, the media would have it that the Mujahideen-e Khalq simply works for the Israelis, assassinating people inside Iran, for example. But it just so happens it was my wife that back in 2006 reported, Larissa Alexandrovna, who reported that Cheney and Rumsfeld were using the MEK inside Iran. She did not say bombings, because I don't think she had sourcing on that, but at least for collecting intelligence, working for the DOD, even if the CIA didn't want to mess with them, which I don't know how clear that is. But now lately they're accused of being the sock puppets of the Israeli Mossad, assassinating scientists, as a CIA... former CIA officer Robert Baer said on MSNBC, well, they're killing people that couldn't possibly actually, you know, degrade their nuclear program at all, but they could provoke retaliation against the United States. This is Israel trying to bait the Iranians into attacking the Americans to get us into a war. Anyway, I guess we can get to that in a minute. If you want to comment on that now, go ahead, or on any of that. Jeremiah, but where we left off at the break, you were talking about what you actually learned firsthand in observing the MEK cult, and then, of course, also and what you learned from interviewing former members of the cult.
Sure. So what I saw was during a night visit to Camp Ashraf, we saw members of the group who wear their olive drab uniforms, look very martial, standing guard to keep its members from actually trying to escape. There was the camp has several houses.
A little iron curtain, I guess.
Exactly. They have these little fences around the housing units, and there was a significant number of guards to prevent the MEK members from running to the nearby or neighboring U.S. Facility. In fact, they at one point asked the Americans for more concertina wire, so they could actually make it harder for MEK members to escape. During the day, I saw some of an organized sort of dog and pony show type tour, having heard the Onion News Network advertisement at the break, there was a particularly sort of absurd and funny moment during this, where we walked into the library at Camp Ashraf. They have a lovely small library. But it was locked, and we were taken in because it was supposed to have been unlocked for the tour, but it was locked. And after we were there for about 10 minutes, people who were supposed to look like they were just browsing the shelves arrived, although obviously the place was locked. And we also went to a park where they had failed to turn on the waterfall until after we arrived. Similarly, they had failed to turn the music on at the cemetery until after we were there.
Kind of makes you wonder whether maybe some of the cult leaders were kind of dragging ass on following their instructions just to make that point to you, you know? Here they are. When they show up at the library, they're all right in the middle of looking at something, even though the place was empty a second ago. All right, now, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Okay, that's what I just want to say about what I saw firsthand. A lot of the specific details I heard from former members, because, you know, as with most, serious cults, there are lots of things that will not be shown except to those who have been initiated. For instance, they have these things called sessions where different quantities of the members have to come together for a meeting in which the members will be forced to disclose the sexual thoughts that they've had about anyone or other members. And if when they disclose them, they're berated because they're not supposed to have those thoughts. But of course, they're human. And so if they deny having the sexual thoughts, they're also berated for obviously lying. So just, you know, that's just a particular example of the unpleasantness of the cult aspects of the MEK.
Well, I want to ask about Camp Ashraf, but more important, I guess, is all the stuff I already sort of brought up all over your interview. I should let you have a chance to address reporting, not just Larissa, but others reporting about the MEK working for the United States over the last few years, and then recent reports that they are working for the Israeli Mossad and behind the assassinations of nuclear scientists in Iran.
Well, I think the type of information I have is also from the public record. It sounds like similar information you have. What I saw as sort of a characteristic is that the MEK is an opportunistic organization, and it has tried to work with the U.S. in various ways. At Camp Ashraf, there were regular meetings between MEK leadership and U.S. military officials, and I sat in on at least one of these meetings where it was basically a constant flow of news of how awful the Iranian regime is, and offers to help do something against the Iranian regime. The MEK constantly offers itself up as a source of intelligence. It's done this since before the Iraq War, but certainly throughout. And I spoke with some American intelligence officials and military officers who would be in Baghdad and have MEK members show up and start offering various bits of intelligence on what was going on in Iran or Iranian activities within Iraq. And so, yes, they've been trying to provide intelligence for a long time. The quality of that intelligence, the perceptions of the quality of that intelligence varies throughout the government. It did during the Bush administration. Some people seem to be somewhat predisposed to find them to be more useful if they happen to be more predisposed towards wanting to invade Iran. As you'll recall, in 2003, there was a bit of an on-to-Tehran attitude among some of the strong pro-Iraq war hawks. And, within the government, you definitely heard it among officials such as Cheney and Rumsfeld, some of the on-to-Tehran attitudes. At least once Rumsfeld said publicly that they would use the MEK as a resource if they were to invade Iran, at least as bullet catchers. So there's been this desire to cooperate. Also, the MEK, I presume, wants to cooperate as a sort of a negotiating position to get off of the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. So that's a key bit of the history that I hadn't gotten to earlier. They were added to the FTO list in 1997, and the factual predicate for that was the assassination of several Americans in Tehran during the time of the Shah. The MEK has been working hard to get off of the terrorist list for years, and the paying of several officials, prominent American ex-officials, to give speeches on the group's behalf has as a the sort of primary purpose of that is for them to make bold statements to say that the MEK needs to be removed from the list.
All right, y'all. We're talking with Jeremiah Gulka. He worked in the Bush Justice Department and then went to work for the RAND Corporation, where he was one of the authors of this 2009 monograph about the Mujahideen-e-Khalq in Camp Ashraf, Iraq. And we'll be right back after this. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Jeremiah Gulka. He used to work in the Bush DOJ, then for the RAND Corporation. Wrote this 2009 monograph, The Mujahideen-e-Khalq in Iraq, A Policy Conundrum. And he has told the story of their history, a communist group that helped with the revolution against the Shah and for Khomeini, and then they were marginalized by Khomeini, and then they fled to Iraq, and they fought on Saddam's side in the Iran-Iraq War, which is why all the Iranian people love them so much and want them to come and be their new government. And how then they've been working for the U.S. and or Israel in the last few years since the 2003 invasion. Anyway, they were, during the occupation, protected by the Americans. Now their fate is in jeopardy, And before we get to all the American politicians here, I wanted to try to get to the motive behind what's the big deal about the terrorist list here. And if I understand it right, Jeremiah, their problem, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq's problem in Iraq, is that they want to be able to stay a group and be able to leave Iraq and go, I don't know where, Europe or even, heaven forfend, America, and stay together as their cult group. Whereas, as long as they are on the terrorist list, then they won't be allowed to leave Iraq as a group. They'll basically be spread to the wind, set free more or less by the Maliki government, but spread to the wind, to, you know, land wherever they can as individuals. And that is what Myra Mirjavi doesn't want at all costs. In fact, she was even kind of threatening, you know, to provoke a major conflict over whether her people would leave Camp Ashraf immediately or not, from Paris, of course, from the safety of Paris, France. Is that about right, or could you correct me where I'm off the story here?
It's almost right, and it is indeed what the MEK is saying, more or less, but it doesn't quite work out that way. So the MEK wants to be off of the Foreign Terrorist Organization list for a bunch of reasons. One real important reason is money and fundraising. Their assets are frozen, and it becomes a federal crime for them to raise money or for people to give money to them as material support of terrorism. So that's a big deal. In terms of the other countries accepting the MEK, well, being on the FTO list probably matters, in part for that. Are any countries going to want to take in a group that is on the American FTO list? That's the question. But taking them off the FTO list, will that make a difference? Well, first of all, it won't actually help them come into America, because once you're off of the list, the people are no longer barred from coming into the United States, except if they have, while they were a member of an FTO, did they receive what's called military-type training. And most of them did or appear to have done so, as you can see from the promotional materials of loads of the different folks driving tanks around, marching in military formation, using the various types of military materiel that Saddam gave them. So there's at least a significant question about how many of them could come into the United States, even if they were taken off of the FTO list. Now, you definitely hit on a good point, which is that the MEK wants to stay together as a group, and of course it does. It's a cult group, and it wants to maintain its members and its numbers. No country has raised a hand to say we want to bring in 3,400 members of this cult group, and it's pretty unlikely that any are going to. Now, there is a real issue here. The only place where most of them can go is Iran, because they're Iranian citizens. Now, it's actually a crime to be a member of the MEK in Iran. So you have to break down and ask who could actually go to Iran. And the only way for anyone to go to Iran would be if they cut their ties with the MEK. Now, a couple hundred former members have returned to Iran. It appears that they have been treated just fine, but they went back cutting ties with the MEK. So the MEK has no interest in having anyone go back to Iran, because it means losing members. So they are promoting the notion that anyone to go back to Iran will immediately be very persecuted. So what the United States is doing, and back when I was at RAND, the report I wrote recommended a process that the U.S. has now more or less adopted in concert with Iraq and with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, which is to go through an individualized process for each person to find out what is their situation, are they interested in going back to Iran, and do they face a reasonable, serious threat of persecution if they went back to Iran. And this is a fundamental principle in international law called, it's a French word called non-refoulement, which means you can't be sent somewhere where you have a significant threat of being persecuted. So this process has begun. A few hundred people from the MEK have gone to the former Camp Liberty, which is in Baghdad, and their process of processing individuals has begun. It's been a long time process to actually get the MEK to agree to this, and As Secretary Clinton said in Congress, and as their court filings say, the State Department will review the FTO status kind of in light of whether or not they cooperate. So, you know, does that mean that they'll actually get off the list? Unknown. But, you know, this is a negotiating point of view that the MEK has to cooperate if they want a chance of getting taken off.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, I wanted to highlight this important story from the National Iranian American Council. Mujahideen supporters envision tit-for-tat campaign against Iran, and it's Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney pretty much openly saying, yeah, we want them delisted from the officially designated list of terrorist organizations so that we can use them as terrorists against the Iranians. And just, I mean, he knows it's the age of YouTube and Treat a Parsi, but still he goes on anyway. So there we have that. But now, I'm sorry because we only have a couple of minutes here, but I was wondering if you could address the money. Who is paying the Mujahideen to pay Giuliani, Fran Townsend, Generals Hayden and Clark and Louis Free, the former head of the FBI, and all of these people to shill for this communist terrorist cult? Where are they getting their money? Is it from the Mossad or is it from the CIA or somebody else?
Well, this is the big question, and that's where the Treasury Department has instigated an investigation, and they've sent subpoenas to the people you mentioned and several more to see where that money is coming from. You know, is it coming from MEK sources? Who are the donors? Are there people making donations or private citizens who are thereby making effectively contributions that count as material support of terrorism under the statute? Or what? And so it's an open question for now. It'll be interesting to see how this investigation proceeds and to see who they then follow up with on it in terms of any potential criminal prosecutions against anyone, be it donors or recipients of that money or what. But that's definitely on people's minds now. But it is interesting to see that the Treasury Department did start this investigation, sending subpoenas to these officials, which certainly looks like an effort to do some curtailing of what the President Obama called the loose talk of war. The folks who are going out there to promote the MEK's removal from the FTO list, this is also in the context of how we deal with Iran. And as I said in my Salon piece, a lot of the officials who are coming out in favor of the MEK have strong ties into the military industrial complex, and they could stand to benefit handsomely from any type of activity with Iran, even just the threat, but certainly more from a bombing, and certainly yet more from actual invasion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm trying to remember which one it was. Anyway, it's too late now. I guess I was going to mention that Christian Science Monitor piece anyway by Scott Peterson from about a year ago or so, where he really talks about how much these people are getting paid and that kind of thing. Interesting footnote anyway. Thank you very much for your time, Jeremiah. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. That's Jeremiah Gulka. Check him out at Glenn Greenwald's blog, salon.com/opinion/Greenwald, MEK and its material supporters in Washington, and his monograph on the MEK for Rand.